The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, hello everybody, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. Here we are on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. One more week, this program is heard at this time every week here on Progressive Radio Network, and we're happy that you're listening. It is available on a podcast, which we'll tell you about later. You can go to the PRN FM website and download the podcast afterwards. It's also on iTunes, so you'll be able to hear the program later if you you'll be able to send it to friends if you want. We're meeting today in a solemn mood, thinking about the end of the Iraq war, and a war that really hasn't ended, but we're told has ended. We have the New York Times today using a phrase that I found particularly peculiar. Iraqis are now left with a land not exactly at peace. That's what the New York Times reports. Not exactly at peace. Well, not exactly, folks. More than a million Iraqis died in this war. They're not really mentioned in any of the stories. Most of the war has been treated by the media as all about us. You know, AAU, all about us. It's all about Americans, our soldiers, our troops, our plans, our politicians. Very little about Iraq and what this war has done to that country. And what's curious about it is here we have the New York Times op-ed page today with a expert from Norway writing a column and saying basically that the Iraq we're leaving behind has been turned into a pro-Iranian country. That, in other words, Iran has won the Iraq war, according to this. He says that the war has left a country that's politically unstable, increasingly volatile, and at risk of descending into the sort of sectarian fighting that killed thousands in 2006 and 2007. Those words again, not exactly. So here we have experts talking about, really this war as a crime. It was a crime. It is a crime to this day. And it's a crime that we are now celebrating the end of, as if none of this happened, as if none of these war crimes, Abu Ghraib, and the other horrors of this war, the media deception that I cataloged in my film, WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception. None of that's discussed in the media. It's not even mentioned that the United States was trying really hard to stay in Iraq, that it was trying to persuade the Iraqi government to really ask us to remain, and the Iraqi people would have none of it. They rejected it. So Americans are now saying the war is over, good. The Iraqis are now saying good riddance. And I write about this more on AlJazeera.com, the website of the Al Jazeera Network. And it's one of the biggest news websites in the world. I just found out that the LA Times had picked up some of my thoughts from an earlier column there. So you can go there or visit my blog at newsdissector.com, which has an elaboration on these points that I'm making here, this news and information. The Times is also, writing a column here about abandoning our friends, basically saying that the people of Iraq who supported the United States, who worked for the United States, who took risks on behalf of the United States, who put their lives on the line, sometimes gave up their lives, those people had hopes or expectations that the United States would take care of them, would allow them to come here. And what happened instead is a very, what they call a Byzantine process, which makes it almost impossible for them to get admission into the United States, despite all the promises that were made, despite their expectations and hopes. So we're in a situation here, where the war is really tragic, but it's also really an indictment of not only the Bush administration, but our Obama administration, which has carried on so many of the policies of the Bush administration. It's shocking. It's really unsettling. And we need to examine this because we're getting into a situation that seems to be going from bad to worse. The Afghanistan war is continuing. The United States is continuing to play a role there for who knows for how long. And the defense authorization bill that's just been passed includes provisions that allows the government to arrest Americans and send them to Guantanamo if they're considered to be supporting terrorism in some vague and undefined way. So we have a situation where this war basically went to war on American traditions, American civil liberties, the Bill of Rights, a lot of the things that we hold near and dear. So it's not just something that happened out there. It's something that has, in a sense, come back at us in the United States, as these wars tend to do. So now we have all of these young men coming home to no jobs, to broken families, to wounded bodies, to mental problems, to all of these issues that have really in a sense, stained not only our country, but have left so many families and individuals in worse shape than they ever were, with nobody really talking about it, nobody really commenting upon it. And that's really what's so tragic here. And we've seen this even in the Occupy Wall Street movement, where some, you know, recent veterans were, you know, protesting and participating. And one of them got hit with a gas grenade in Oakland, California, and is basically was damaged. His brain was damaged. We don't know if he's going to recover or not fully, but it certainly is a sign that, you know, the society seems to be getting meaner, more hostile, less accepting of protest, accepting of what, you know, this country is supposedly all about. And this is some of the issues we're going to be talking with. I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me Ray Lewis, a former captain of the Philadelphia Police Department, who showed up at Occupy Wall Street with his uniform and supported the occupation. And for his troubles and for his courage and his stand, he was denounced by some of the executives of the Philadelphia Police Department and arrested by the NYPD, and he's here to tell the tale. He's been very visible in standing up for the principles that he believes in, and we're going to hear more about that in a second. We hope to be talking a little bit more about foreclosures on the program as well, and here's a song to set the stage.
One of the most important parts of a reform agenda is to encourage people to own something, own their own home. Government must stand on the side of people. Because I understand if you own something, you have a vital stake.
I heard my dad saying we might lose our home.
My home.
3 million families now are said to be in danger of foreclosure. That's a 50-state Katrina. What started as manipulations and maneuvers on Wall Street has now moved to Main Street.
The cascading impact of the subprime mess is clear. No mortgage relief plan can undo the loose practices of the real estate bubble.
What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. And that holds true. Foreclosures have skyrocketed.
Not because they've lost their jobs. Not because of life circumstances. But because the mortgage is pushing them into foreclosure. Never has it happened before. People have the same income, the same job, but are losing their home.
The meltdown of the subprime mortgage market, how can I make this work for me?
They all displace themselves in our communities and rip people off.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this.
I approve that message. That was the voice of George W. Bush, who, of course, was promoting this policy of giving every American should own their own home. But he didn't really talk about the way to own the homes, or to take out these subprime fraudulent mortgages, which ended up forcing them into foreclosure. It was a deliberate. It was by design. I did a film about this called Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, an investigation into the financial crisis. And I started out, Ray Lewis, looking into this as, you know, a business problem. They made mistakes. They miscalculated. These guys on Wall Street, even though they're so smart, they got a little greedy. And, you know, and the whole Humpty Dumpty fell down and crashed, you know. And then I began looking more closely, and what I discovered was that a lot of these policies were quite intentional. They knew exactly what they were doing. They had mathematical models examining, you know, what was likely to happen, the number of foreclosures to expect, and all the rest of it. This wasn't done, simply as a result of errors. It was a plan. And it was a plan that many industries worked together on. That's what most people don't know to this day, including the people at Occupy, that the insurance industry is represented by AIG, which insured the big banks, the finance industry, of course, that invested in all of this, and also the real estate firms that went out and peddled these homes to try to attract and seduce people into buying homes they knew they couldn't afford. But they got them in, and then as a result, they're now taking the homes back. 14 million people are in the category of either in or facing foreclosure in America. That's a catastrophe. That's not like, you know, a handful of folks who made mistakes. These are the folks who actually knew exactly, didn't know exactly what they were getting into. They thought they would have a deal here. It seemed affordable. And then the so-called ARM mortgages, the interest rates went up, and their jobs were they lost their jobs, and they had no money. And guess what? They ended up in the street or moving in with other members of their families. And this has happened in city after city after city. You know, what's ironic about all of this, and you're a police officer, career police officer, Ray, is that Wall Street today is one of the most highly secured area. It's almost like a no-go zone in Northern Ireland that the British Army sealed off. They have surveillance cameras looking, you know, at every single person on the street. The Occupy Wall Street, they had a whole truck there, a whole unit that was filming 24 hours a day, every single person with cameras that could zoom in on them, actually even hear what they were saying. So it was a total surveillance environment. And that's what they did on Wall Street. Ironically, there were no cameras on the inside documenting what they were talking about and what they were doing. In other words, they're planning, they're scheming to create this crisis to benefit themselves and to cost the rest of us our whole economy. So law enforcement can be selective. You know, goes after the people at the bottom, not the people at the top. And that's why to this day, there have been no prosecutions, indictments, arraignments, arrests of the top CEOs in the financial industry. You know, just as a cop, how do you feel about that? What do you think people in America feel about that?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Danny. And I want to make sure everyone knows that I am a retired Philadelphia police captain. I've been retired for 8 years. And, Danny, what you say is so true about all of this observation was on the outside and nothing on the inside. Almost all of crime, when people think of crime, they think of the street level crime. But almost all of this can invariably be traced back to white collar crime. One of my signs at the Zuccotti Park, Occupy Wall Street, is I'm encouraging people. It says, watch Inside Job. Inside Job is a documentary about the Wall Street, and it's particularly the default mortgage crash in 2008. And it's extremely enlightening when you have all the interviews of the individuals who were involved. And as Danny said, this was a scheme, a well-thought-out scheme. This was not an accident. These were criminal acts. And what happens? Nothing. No one was held accountable for this. But we want to make sure we arrest the guy that steals a bicycle to try to get to his job at McDonald's.
You know, Ray, your presence in the park, you may not know this, it really lifted the spirits of the people there. It really showed that, you know, they were not alone and not just a bunch of disgruntled people, that people from every walk of life, you know, has been by there. It was sympathetic to the people, expressed, you know, support. Tourists coming by on tourist buses, people walking down. People were saying, at least somebody's doing something. They're standing up. It's time, isn't it? Even though they might not, but you did. What motivated you to get so deeply involved?
Well, I was always an activist. I've protested the Vietnam War. And so this was always my train of thought. I saw the corruption in government. I saw the corruption, the total corruption, everywhere you looked. But I did my little part in law enforcement to try to do it in a constitutional way to help people with their problems respectfully and professionally. After I retired 8 years ago, I moved up to the mountains in seclusion to get away from all this. I didn't want to deal with all of this. And subsequently, my wife and I bought a small farm up in the mountains a year prior to me retiring. But
now, which mountains were these? The Catskills, right?
Okay. Yeah. But
they're not the Rockies.
Yeah.
He was nearby. Okay.
But even though up there I read no newspapers, no media magazines, no TV. My wife felt a little isolated, so we got a computer for her to communicate with friends and read whatnot. So I started following the internet news, specifically a lot of blogs, websites, independent media, which is the only place you're going to get the real truth. And I read about Zuccotti Park, and I said, finally, I would not be solo running around as I was called Chicken Little, screaming that the sky is falling. There were other people now who I could relate to, and most importantly, I felt I could have a significant contribution with my uniform, and that I have.
Which is kind of amazing to see all these people in the park, and here's a man, you know, white shirt, blue uniform of the Philadelphia Police Department, city of brotherly love, the city that gave birth in a way to the American Constitution, to our Bill of Rights. This was all happening in Philadelphia. And here today, out of Philadelphia, comes a cop, you know, a captain, no less, of the Philadelphia Police Department in uniform, comes to Zuccotti Park and joins the protest, not asking for any leadership role, not asking for anything for himself, just participating. And he became a magnet for the media. He became a magnet for the activists. Who is this guy? What's he doing here? Is he a spy? Is he here to maintain surveillance? And meanwhile, the New York City cops went nuts. A cop in the park? Oh, my goodness. You know, and so what happened here, not only was he arrested, you know, on Wall Street, and he had been a cop for 24 years. This is not like an afternoon of policing, you know. The Fraternal Order of the Police informed Brother Lewis that his organization had received a grievance against him. And this was a grievance by the organization, by other cops who were complaining that he was making comments that they didn't approve of. The Philadelphia police, unbelievably, said by wearing his uniform, it was like going to a Ku Klux Klan meeting. Did you know that? He was attacked. I have the article here, Ray. You're going to enjoy this one.
That's a new one.
You know, basically attacking him as being some kind of a racist. I mean, look at this. Just read a little of this for us. This is unbelievable. Just read it aloud.
Despite the amazing pictures and produced during Occupation Wall Street Day of Action, we here at the New York Observer were wondering about the ethical legal implications of Philadelphia's retired Captain Ray Lewis, who joined with the protesters the night before Zuccotti Park was raided, and was arrested on November 17th in full uniform, wearing his police-issued garb while joining with the demonstrators. Now Philadelphia's Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey has written a letter to Captain Lewis, along with the Fraternal Order of Police, admonishing him for his actions. We spoke to the Philadelphia Police Department Public Affairs Office Lieutenant Ray Evers, asking him to clarify some of the issues regarding a police officer in uniform while not actively serving. The letter that Commissioner Ramsey warned Captain Lewis reads, to immediately cease and desist wearing, using, or otherwise displaying any official Philadelphia Police Department uniform, badges, or facsimiles thereof, or any official departmental insignia. Be advised that I am prepared to take any and all necessary actions to protect the honor and integrity of the Philadelphia Police Department. Wow. Do you want me to comment on that first before I go on?
You're reading it here for the first time. That's why I think it's interesting. Yeah.
Well, I do have this letter, but this is the first article.
Yeah.
But that letter was sent to me to immediately cease and desist, and also that he would take any and all necessary action. Okay. What's interesting about this letter, Danny, is, number one, he failed in that entire letter to cite any law, statute, or policy I was violating. Subsequently, here's the meat of these threatening letters. Neither one of them cite what I'm violating. It's all threats, and they're trying to intimidate me without any basis. Subsequently, from this threat, I feel I may be justified to get a restraining order against Commissioner Ramsey of Philadelphia, and also from President John McNesby of the Fraternal Order of Police.
Why are your brother policemen so freaked out about the actions of one person here in New York?
That's a good question. I think the best answer would have to come from them. You know what? There were two things I thought when I opened that letter, that threatening letter. from both individuals, from the FOP president and from the Philadelphia Commissioner Ramsey. The first thought I had, well, before opening the FOP letter, I saw it was, you know, it was from the FOP. And by the way, the FOP is the equivalent of your PBA. It's the
Police Benevolent Association, right?
Yeah. And technically, it's not a union, technically, because we can't go on strike. Unions have the right to go on strike, but they're referred to as unions. But when I saw the insignia up in the left-hand corner of the envelope, I thought that they were going to say, thank you, brother. We appreciate what you're doing. We're going to help you. Let us know what we can do. Well, far from the truth. I then opened the letter, saw how they were threatening me. They included a grievance submitted by the pension director, Henry Vanelli. Why would Henry Vanelli, the pension director, get involved in this?
This writ to your pension.
Exactly. But I know, because I checked this, I didn't come down here blind. I know they cannot touch my pension. I have taken precautions to know that they cannot touch my pension, and also that I could not be arrested unless I impersonated a police officer. To impersonate a police officer, you have to take an articulable act, and I never ordered anyone to do anything. But when I opened this letter, by both of these individuals, John McNesby and, Robert Ballantyne actually wrote the letter for John McNesby, and then Police Commissioner Ramsey. After reading both of them, here's what I thought. I thought, how could they be so stupid as to put their threat in writing and then affix their signatures?
Well, there you go. I mean, this is part of the flack, if you will, that Ray Lewis has attracted. Now, I understand Mr. Mandelman is on the phone. Martin Mandelman, is that correct? Can we just bring him into the conversation? Martin, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know if you can hear this or not, but when you weren't there, we have the 24-year veteran of the Philadelphia Police Department, Captain Ray Lewis, retired, joining us here. And Captain Ray was extremely brave and gutsy to go down to Zuccotti Park and support the demands for economic justice, to support the demands to investigate, you know, the banksters, if you will. And, you know, Ray, I want you to meet Martin Mandelman. Martin Mandelman, I would say, is my guru when it comes to standing up for people facing foreclosure. He's written 600 articles basically talking about how the people who were basically confronted and threatened and lost their homes were being blamed for the whole financial crisis when that wasn't the case. True, Martin?
That's right. It's certainly right. Crazy what's going on. I know who Captain Ray is. I mean, I saw him. I recognize the voice. I saw him on a video, I think on YouTube. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, I've been on various media.
Well, I wanted you guys to at least interact and meet. We were going to talk mostly about foreclosures, but we're at the point now of also talking about resistance. How do you challenge foreclosures or illegal actions? In some cases, companies have foreclosed on homes they didn't even own, okay? They asserted ownership with no proof whatsoever, and they basically threw people out of their homes illegally. And this was basically allowed by the courts, by judges, or by, you know, various authorities. And that to me is...
Well, that happens every day.
Every day?
Every day. Every day all over the country, every day. Every single day. 3,300 times. There are 3,300 evictions, roughly. Somewhere between 3,200 and 3,100. Something around a little over 3,000 evictions every day in this country. Every day.
And
the vast majority are fraudulent.
I mean, so in other words, people who got fraudulent mortgages in the first place, who were talked into taking these mortgages, now are on the receiving end of fraudulent foreclosures, you know, with the pretense of law and order behind it all. I mean, this is shocking.
Well, barely a pretense. Can I explain why that is?
Yeah, please do. Let me just say something, Martin.
Very simply.
Let me just say one thing.
Yeah.
Say what you're going to say. We're going to have to take a short break, and then we'll come back and continue for the rest of the hour. We're going to be joined by one of the Occupy Wall Street activists as well.
Oh,
Ray is
great.
Going to be staying with us. So instead of this orderly, planned discussion that I was going to host, we have a free-for-all here, which is much better radio and much more interesting. Go ahead, Martin Andelman. Martin, we should tell our listeners, writes a very, very important blog called Mandelman Matters. Mandelman Matters. And basically, it's on the implode, ml-implode.com website. Mandelman Matters. If you want to follow this issue of foreclosures, if you want to meet a man who's been speaking out on this issue with great passion, eloquence, and determination, you want to know Martin Andelman. Now, tell us why, Martin, and then we're going to take our break and come back.
Okay. All right. Here's what's happened here, and judges are letting this happen because people come to court and they say, well, you haven't made a payment. So since you haven't made a payment, even though the bank, we don't really know if this servicer owns it or not because there's no proof of that, because you haven't made a payment, we're going to go ahead and just let them foreclose and evict you. Now, these loans were securitized, meaning that there was nobody lending the money. They originated a loan. They sold them off to Wall Street, who sliced them up and sold securities all over the world. And now when they come into court to foreclose, they don't really have anything that says this trust owns it. They're unable, it's stunning, but they are unable to produce any paperwork that says that the people that are foreclosing own the loan. But the judges, not all, and it's changing, but the judges up until now have said, well, you're right, I don't know whether they own it or not, but I know you haven't made a payment, so that's it. And the people, this is a silent crisis, because the people caught up in this, of course, were trying to get their loan modified. I mean, let's face it, the President of the United States went on television on February 19th, 2009, and said, you can get your loan modified. And so the people were told by the bank, don't make your payment, because you're going to get your loan modified. And then a year, 2 years, whatever later, they said, nope, sorry, we're not going to modify it. We're foreclosing. And now these people are forced into court with the judge. They're saying, wait a minute, they don't even own my loan. How can they take my house back? And the judges think that they're saying, well, since you haven't made a payment, we're just going to give it back to whoever.
Yeah, I mean, let's let the people understand what we're talking about here. When you slice and dice, a securitized bond or housing bond or whatever it is,
yeah,
it means that, you know, Mrs. Chin in Singapore owns your bathtub. Mrs., you know, somebody else in the Philippines, you know, owns your living room. You know, in other words, this is all
right.
A mess. You can't really even prove who owns what. And yet the people who are being evicted don't know that and don't get the proper legal representation. And even when they do, the judges don't really understand it themselves, don't listen to the claims and dismiss them and evict the people. So this is a chain of criminality here.
Yeah, but here's what we know, okay? I can't tell you necessarily who owns a loan, but I can tell you they don't. This person doesn't. And so the judges think that they are protecting the banking industry, but really what they're doing is they're allowing fraud against the investors to continue because these loans were sold to more than one trust at the same time. That's why they don't want to show the paperwork. That's why they can't show anything. The banks are controlling these trusts. The investors do not know which loans they own. And the homeowners don't know who owns their loan, and the banks sit in the middle, and they robo-sign. They call it robo-signing. It sounds like a stuffed animal. It's fraud and forgery. Robo-signing is fraud and forgery. Fraudulent affidavits are signed and brought into
court. By a machine.
That's right, and registered with the Register of Deeds. There are thousands of documents that are fraudulent embedded in our registrar's office all across the country. That's what the AG settlement is about. That's what is going on with Attorney General Masto in Las Vegas. And the only reason that Las Vegas is suing first is because the heat is hottest there first. But it's coming soon to a theater near you. Every state's going to feel this. We're going to learn it the hard way, I'm afraid.
This is sick, everyone. This is disgusting. This is something to get outraged about. This is not something to simply write PhD theses about. These are real Americans, real people getting really steamrolled and losing their homes. Their homes are being stolen from them. Their children who are enrolled in school have to go somewhere else. They're living in cars in some parts of America. They're living in parks. And this is a crime against humanity, really perpetrated by Wall Street and by the people who worked in complicity with Wall Street. Let's be clear about that. We'll be back in a minute with more, with Ray Lewis, with Martin Andelman, and we're going to be joined by Laura from Occupy Wall Street. This is getting hot. This is getting good. Stay with us, 888-874-4888 to join. The anthem of the film In Debt We Trust that I made in 2006, predicting the financial crisis. I was called an alarmist, a doom and gloomer. You know, didn't know what I was talking about until suddenly the markets melted down. Then I went from being a zero to a hero. You're a genius. I wasn't a genius. There were a number of people who were following this closely, but not enough in the media were actually predicting what was going to happen because they were shilling for the banks. They were taking advertising from credit card companies, from financial institutions and the like. As a result, our news basically was bought, and as a result, most Americans didn't know what to expect, and they still don't know to this day. Martin Andelman is with us, the author of the Mandelman Matters blog, which appears on ml-implode.com. For my money, the most informed, the most passionate writer about the foreclosure crisis. Laura, are you with us as well?
I'm here.
Okay, Laura is an activist with Occupy Wall Street. There's a big action happening tomorrow, and she's going to tell us about it in a minute. Then I also have Ray Lewis here, the retired Philadelphia police captain who's been active in this whole movement. I just gave Ray, before you came on, Martin, an article basically comparing him to somebody going to a Ku Klux Klan meeting because he wore his Philadelphia Police Department uniform in Zuccotti Park and was arrested in it. And he's been stewing over this. He's digesting it. He hadn't seen the article before from the New York Observer, and he's been reacting to it. And, you know, he points out that the police commissioner in Philadelphia, Mr. Ramsey, who's the head of the Philadelphia police, that's accusing him and attacking him and trying to bully him, actually got his job because of civil disobedience. How did that happen, Ray?
Yes, Danny's right. This is the first time I've seen this, that the Philadelphia police are comparing wearing my uniform to the Occupy Wall Street protest. as the same as wearing my uniform to a Ku Klux Klan meeting. This shows you the mentality of the police official that put this out. That's a sad commentary. And I would just like, I think I have to inform Police Commissioner Rams. First of all, I was arrested for civil disobedience. I sat down, I refused to move, and subsequently, with many others, I was arrested, again, for civil disobedience. So I'd like to inform Commissioner Ramsey that if it was not for civil disobedience a number of years ago, I can guarantee that he would not hold his present position with the Philadelphia Police Department.
There you go. Laura, any thoughts about this? You saw Ray Lewis in the park and among the activists of Occupy Wall Street. What did the OWS folks think about having this man in a police uniform join them?
Well, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I think that it's incredible that he had the bravery to come out there and represent his position wearing his uniform and making it clear who he is. I mean, we know that a lot of the police as individuals are sympathetic to what they're doing and see themselves as part of the 99%. And him actually coming out and being willing to say that in the open, which many can't do because of they need their jobs, just like everybody in the United States needs their jobs, and that's making us afraid to speak out. We're applauding his bravery.
It's interesting, you know, the view of the 99% and the 1%. Seems like the 1% of the police department, so-called white shirts, have actually, instead of supervising the police, instead of controlling the police, which is their sort of task, actually, you know, provoked some of the police violence that took place against people with pepper spray and the like. It was white shirts that were doing this. The supervisors, you know, were actually involved. And here was Ray, one-time supervisor, you know, 24 years on the Philadelphia Police Department, standing with the people of Occupy Wall Street. Ray, comment?
Yeah, Danny, one of the things that really hit me strong when I was looking at all the videos and the pictures of the raid on Zuccotti Park was I was just appalled at the engagement of the white shirts, the supervisors, with the protesters. The supervisors, the white shirts, are there. They're paid. They're trained to supervise. If you're engaging in combat, then who is supervising? No one. That's why you have absolute chaos, and that's the last thing you want to do when you have men with guns and batons and all kind of weapons. The last thing you want is them to be unsupervised.
And Martin, you're an observer of all this from across the country. What was your take on it?
Well, which part? The peppers?
The attack on the camp encampments, the tearing down, you know, these people who are upholding property rights by destroying people's personal, possessions, destroying the people's library, you know, with a mayor who has spoken out against book burning, you know, years ago. I mean, all of this seems like surrealistic. You can't make it up. You can't even predict it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tremendous. I think it's added a lot of people to the cause, certainly. I mean, if you watch what happened on the campus of UC Davis, I don't know. I mean, my daughter went to school there, we'd have a problem. We wouldn't do that to dogs, would you? Would you spray pepper spray at dogs like that?
Well, there you go.
I mean, I don't know. I'm shocked. I'm shocked at this stuff. But I just got to say, I mean, the police are part of the 99%. It's people just don't feel it yet. They don't realize really how bad this is about to be.
Yeah, I mean,
next year at this time, we're going to have a very different radio show.
The International Monetary Fund is now projecting a return to the 30s. They're just suggesting, you know, depression is not that, you know, a kind of just a historical concept, that this could happen, and the way things are going is likely to happen. I mean, that's why...
No, it has happened. It has happened. It is now. Let's be very clear about something. We have pumped almost $14 trillion, and I just saw one at $16 trillion, in stimulus dollars into the economy. You didn't see it. So you don't see it. People didn't see it, so they don't know it's there. It is a depression. It has been. Property values have fallen 74 months in a row. consecutive. Okay, look. It is a depression. The state governments have had $500 billion as part of the stimulus plan. That's why you don't see the austerity measures here. Now there's only $56 billion left. This next year, you will feel it. You just haven't felt it. It is a depression. $14 trillion has been pumped in, and things are as bad as they are today.
And, you know, even Paul Krugman in the New York Times, who was, you know, the kind of voice of reason, the moderate voice of, you know, as an economist, is saying it is a depression, folks. The D word is out of the bag, and people are acknowledging it. And Occupy Wall Street is trying to fight back. Laura, what's the latest? There's a plan for tomorrow, Saturday,
sure,
here in New York. What can you tell us about what's coming up next?
Sure. I mean, just responding to the economic conversation, it's very clear, and all the experts have agreed that, you know, the G word is out of the bag, as you say, and we're in a depression. And what to us is most offensive is that the people who created this depression are still getting paid out for it. For creating it. I mean, according to third quarter SEC filings that were released today, we're looking at $156 billion in compensation for this year that is projected to be doled out by seven U.S. banks. And we can't understand how that type of compensation is still being doled out to the few people who contributed, if not orchestrated, the 2008 collapse of the U.S. economy and the global economy. So, one thing we're doing in order to, essentially what we're doing is trying to raise awareness of this injustice. And to do that, we feel very strongly that we need space that is outdoors and ours in order to organize. And that's why we are involved in an effort, and that's culminating tomorrow in an event, in order to secure us some free outdoor space for a new occupation. Because as everybody knows, we were raided on the 15th. And just going back a little bit to the conversation about the police and about the brutality, it's a very difficult conversation because we're not against individual police numbers. We do see that they are using violence as an overarching police strategy in order for them to provoke us to use violence back, in order to discredit our movement. And we are a nonviolent movement, and so we see that as a strategy that's coming from the top, that's coming from the coordinated call by the 18 mayors and Homeland Security and the FBI, which resulted in the raids across the country, which resulted in an unconstitutional coordination of local police forces in order to turn them into an army that is being used against this movement and against the people. So we have reached out to Trinity Church, which is a very large institutional church in New York City and also a very wealthy real estate company. And we've asked them for sanctuary in an unused lot. And it's part of a broader conversation that we're having as Occupy Wall Street that's saying that the tragedy of this economic depression and collapse is that there are resources and there are people who need these resources. And those things can't come together because banks and large institutions stand in the way. So in the same way that we saw on December 6th, us standing up and saying it's wrong that there's more homeless families than ever on the streets and more foreclosed, unused properties standing in East New York and in the outer boroughs than ever before. Today we're saying we think it's wrong that there is a space where we could be given sanctuary. And we're hoping, but we're not able to access it.
Yeah, we should
and we're
point...
hoping that the church sees that and chooses to partner with us and to grant us access to this space.
Well, the other day I received an email explaining who is on the board, the vestry, whatever it's called,
mm-hmm.
of the church, Trinity Church. And among the people on the board is one of the vice presidents of Brookfield Properties that
yep.
controls Zuccotti Park. And also it reads like a, you know, kind of a who's who of the 1%.
We've got Citigroup represented. We've got Brookfield represented. We've got AIG represented. We've got Merrill Lynch. It's definitely a who's who's list, and that makes us wonder, is Trinity Church on Wall Street a church? Is it a real estate organization that's being controlled by the banks that crashed our economy.
Disguised as a church. You know, a real estate company describes it. But I'm saying it. I'm saying it because you know, if your real estate priorities come before your spiritual priorities and your duties as a, you know, as an institution serving God, then you have to really question what really is going on there. And, you know, I've noticed that OWS has also announced an Occupy the Dream initiative on January 15th, working with black clergymen to honor the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King by continuing his work. So, the point is that this movement, and Martin, I wanted you to know this. We have a caller on the line we're going to get to in a second. This movement has as one of its signs, this is so not over. You know, this is so not over.
So not over.
And to me, you know, that's what's so remarkable about it. So tomorrow, if you want to participate or support the action that's at 6th Avenue and Canal Street, it's happening at noon, I'm told. And I think it's going to be very interesting. The last time there was an attempt there, police turned out, you know, immediately to try to arrest people and throw them off this unused land. This is not, you know, even like Zuccotti Park, which was a park supposedly serving the community. I was just down there the other day. There were about 20 people in the whole park. There were no people from the community wandering around in that park. So that was, you know, deceptive as well. Martin, just to hear all of this, what we're seeing now is the emergence of a fight back that you and I both didn't experience when we started writing about or exposing these practices by the banks.
No, come on. I used to feel like I was standing on top of a hill yelling. I still feel like that on occasion. I think that there's some number. I think there's things that people have to wake up to that you know, things like, and I'm sure the OWS movement is aware of things. You know, in 1988, the average American made, according to the IRS, the average American made $33,400, and in 2008, the average American made $33,000. I mean, there's a problem here. It's taken 30 years to grow. We've all been asleep since the mid 80s when they started pumping credit into the system, and they said, look, you want to be a gold debtor, don't you? I want to be a platinum. I call this gray piece of plastic platinum. It's a platinum card, and I want a sapphire card. It should say order your cement Visa.
Well,
MasterCard.
I'd like an OWS card myself, not as a credit card, but as a card of respect, you know, for the people who are standing up. We have a caller. We want to get his call in quickly if we could. Kevin, I believe is his name.
Hi. Yes, it is. Good afternoon, Mr. Schechter. I just want to make a comment and then sort of take a question. But Ray Lewis, I commend you. I have family members who have served on the law enforcement. I happen to have been in Philadelphia at one point and directly involved with the police matters there. But I will say to you that it's commendable to the highest one that you would come forth in your uniform, because my brothers who are getting pensions and so forth undoubtedly are worried about their pension. I've advised them that it may not be there. It simply may not be there when you retire, because these pension funds, and no one's talking about, are loaded with these derivatives and these worthless mortgage-backed securities and so forth. And I think that's something that the municipal level would need to look at, because the same defaults we're finding in Europe are going to happen here on the level and then on a national level. And I dare say, Mr. Mendelman, as you mentioned, yeah, that black hole is actually $29 trillion deep already afforded to or provided to the banks, and that black hole is because they are absolutely insolvent. And the way we can get to this, and with all due respect, is the economist, and particularly a gentleman, Bill Still. I'll reference his name as whatever his political affiliation, I believe he's with the Libertarian Party. Doesn't matter. But better than Ron Paul, he speaks to the issue of what the currency and the problem is. We must get to the answer of it, because we may be able to stop this if we laser focus in on this problem.
Kevin, thank you for calling. I really appreciate it. I'm sure Ray does as well, to hear people responding the way they do. We only have a few minutes left here. I'd like to go around and have some final comments from our guests. This whole program has turned into this free-for-all of great ideas and tremendous passion, and that's what we try to do on News Dissector Radio every week, also on my blog, newsdissector.com. My film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com, is an indictment of the financial system as a crime story, and also just announcing now, but I've just finished a book called Occupy, with a collection of my articles from Al Jazeera and other outlets about my reporting on the Occupy movement, going back to Tahrir Square, going back to Spain, and to the occupation in New York. It's called Occupy. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org if you're interested in more information. Final comments. First, Laura, quickly.
Sure. We're really excited to see the community out at noon and all day on Saturday. It's going to be an amazing event, lots of music and lots of fun, and hopefully really meaningful in pushing the conversation forward.
Mr. Mandelman, a final comment
here. I'll give you a final comment. It is very important that everybody write to their attorney general. It is very important. It makes a difference.
At the state level,
to their attorney, their state attorney general, that they do not want this whitewash settlement to go on. There will be no money that will end up with homeowners with principal reductions. It should not be done, and it will stop it. We need solutions here, blanket solutions that can stop some of the meltdown in its tracks. Eminent domain, take over all the loans, give equitable mortgages like they did in the 30s. There are a lot of answers to this, but the attorney general are about to sign, and there will be a podcast, Danny, on my site, which you can put on your site this weekend, with a former attorney general from the state of Ohio talking about the need to write to the AGs. This whole thing is our fault. You can blame Wall Street, and I'm right with you, but it's our fault. We let this happen over 30 years by not speaking out at every turn. While the banks were gaining in political influence and influencing our legislation, we went out and bought a sweater. It is our fault. We have to change it. No one else will do it. There will be no one else to help you. We have not gotten involved, and as a result,
Martin,
the credit card reform bill has left us with a credit card that charges 79.9% interest. 79.9.
Wow. Martin,
that exists today.
Martin Edelman.
I
was hoping to hear from you, put you on the air for 12 hours straight, and I don't think you'd repeat a thought, in those 12 hours. Mandelman Matters, mlimplode.com. Check him out. Ray Lewis, final comment. We're running out of time.
Real quick, I want to add to that pepper spray incident in California. What was even worse than the pepper spraying, if you can believe it, was if you watched more of the film, the video, like I had a chance to do, there were officers there with machine guns, assault weapons, and this is outrageous. The police commissioner chief who made the decision to send those officers there that day to a college protest armed with machine guns should be fired. That is even worse than the pepper spraying incident of a single sociopath.
It reminds us of Kent State. There was also, I think, in Memphis or somewhere, a tank was rolled out. Tampa, Florida, because five people were protesting. I mean, we have a militarization of our police underway and an undermining of our Bill of Rights and Constitution. These are things that we need a movement to stand up for. We've also had the attacks continue on Muslim Americans. The Lowe's store pulled out its funding for a program showing the diversity of the Muslim community. And Stefan Saeed, who is a Iraqi American, wrote a song about it, and I think we're going to go out with that song right now on News Dissector Radio. Matt, are you with us? Let it rip.
Long time got been